before we get to Alex, let me just ask you a follow-up on that, Brewster, that question. It does seem like that for certain types of work, particularly visual arts, photographs is what I'm thinking of specifically, that it may be a useful registration may have to have some searching of the actual work itself and the information in the actual work itself for the situation that David raised, which was you have the photograph, but you have nothing else to identify it. It may be possible by comparing that digital version of that photograph with a database of digital photographs, you could be able to match up the image in some way and start down the path of find the owner through that way. I guess the concern that people have raised and would raise with the notion of depositing the entire copy of the work would be particularly where that copy and the database of copies that is being collected is made available, is made accessible. The question is, would that I would expect copyright owners and authors to say, I don't want my work to suddenly, my efforts to sell my work or make it available in this channel have to compete with the Library of Congress or any other depository library who would be getting all of these copies that are there for the purpose of creating a registration system for identifying the owner. So I guess in some cases, and it may not even be necessary in some cases, although it may be more useful to have a complete copy of the work as part of a registration system, how do we address the concern that one place where people are registering their works and their information doesn't become the place everyone goes to get a copy of the work or get access to the work in some place, in the worst case scenario being a real detriment to other online, right, either for pay or other sources for the works that would be maybe in direct competition with that kind of system.
At least. Just because there's a copy in the Library of Congress doesn't mean that everybody suddenly has it. I think we've kind of gotten over that. You know, if there's one digital copy, suddenly everybody has it. Problem, or argument. But there is this issue of if there is a copy of record someplace, is my copy diminished? And in the rare works, artworks, or in very limited copy books, at editions of less than 100, sending in a copy might be of undue burden. In the digital world, sending that copy in probably is not an undue burden. Then there's a question, is there a problem once it's in the library system towards making it more available? I think that's what we have laws for. And we have this copyright law, and we have a very conservative librarian community towards being nice and playing by the rules. Having navigation tools to be able to make access to these orphaned works is actually a multi-million dollar project of a commercial company around this table. So there are people that would be very interested in finding the right level of fair use or orphan work use of these materials, but we're all law-abiding groups. So I think we're okay, but obviously that's not a great answer to your question.
I had Alex on my list, and then Chris has his hand up.
But I guess what I wanted to follow up on is something Julie, you had said about incentives. I think the Copyright Office and in this procedure has a tremendous ability and opportunity to provide some incentives so that copyright holders do come forward and are more easily findable. And the other thing I would point out there is when Barbara talks about going out and trying to find a copyright holder, she has a certain amount of money and resources that she can do that with. And if, let's say, the resources for a particular clip is something like $5,000, well, if it takes her $3,000 to find that individual, then there's only $2,000 left to pay them with. And I think one of the things that you really do have the opportunity to do here is to make it so that more of that money and more of that finding money actually goes to the artist, to the individual, or to the rights holder. The only other thing I would say is that to the extent that we propose things here, we do have the ability to create incentive structures and to have technology really grow into that. And I think Stephen's organization is a great example here, where there was a problem in terms of music that was available online, and Stephen's organization has done a tremendous amount in terms of innovating on that problem to be able to recognize when a user has mistyped the name of a song and not just have to rely on copyright records. in order to try to figure out what is out there and what is the same work from work to work to work.
Okay, let's. Okay, coming up on the lunch break, and we're only going to do an hour, so I want to make sure. Dwayne, go ahead, and Christine, Maureen, and Bruce. That'll be it.
I don't know that I necessarily like a separate registry system, separate from the registration system, but I do think that to the extent that we need incentives to get folks to engage themselves in registration, that those already exist. Chris ran down those a while ago, and those are actually very powerful incentives, and I think that the people that are interested in exercising their rights and protecting their rights are already using those. And I'm not convinced that you're going to create another incentive system that are going to further encourage people that let their works become orphans now go on to this registry list. Because I think that the ones that they're interested in protecting in a commercial marketplace kind of sense are being registered.
Not true.
Why is that not happening then? I mean, what does not trigger a commercial actor to say, well, if I want to protect statutory damages and I want to get attorney's fees, why would they not register it?
That's a good question, but we can tell you, for example, that okay. In the record industry, where you think there's value, the registration rates are abysmal. Why? We don't know. But where you've got incentives already written into the law, where you think they work, they haven't.
I have
an idea for why. You know, copyright proponents, I think, have a particular form of hubris, and that is that in order to make a business case out of a piece of creative work, you need copyright. Sometimes you do. Often you do. But sometimes you don't. And the music industry is a good example where, you know, the way music is developing is we're fragmenting the audience, we're satisfying a lot of niche tastes, and these tastes come and go. And so being first to market with a marketing plan and doing it well might get you the rents that you want out of work, and so copyright becomes a relatively limited utility. You know, again, historical research that I've done that looks at, for example, the San Francisco publishing industry in the late 1800s shows some publishers, the same publisher, publishing works in a year that they register and some that they don't. And they charge money for the works that they don't register, and the reason that they think they can get away without registering is they think for this particular work, copyright is not really going to drive the success of my business plan. Something else is. And so for the music industry, I think that's perfectly plausible that for lots of works, you know, this week's hottest dance track in the clubs, copyright irrelevant, because by the time someone's pirating it, they're moving on. Fashion industry, okay? Copyright does not apply, mostly, to dress designs. I mean, there's a very limited application of copyright to dress designs. The fashion industry dwarfs most other content industries. It's intensely creative. There's tons of thievery. And if anything, the thievery drives creativity. So I just want to make clear, I'm not someone who, you know, says that copyright doesn't have a place. I think copyright's incredibly important. I think if someone's going to invest $100 million in the making of a movie, they better copyright it, right? They better register. But copyright shouldn't be seen as the answer to every business problem.
I had Christine and Maureen on my list. We're coming up on lunch. I have a feeling most of these issues will be talked about again after we come back from lunch, but I'll give you a chance if you'd like to make a final comment.
Well, I agree with the notion of there's more than copyright in this question. And with art, visual art, it's an ongoing process. It doesn't stop. And I think that this is the reason why a lot of artists don't register, is because when do you call it the end? It's not like a book that you send in for publication. It's definitely a work in progress at all times. Artists go back and change things. So that's part of the problem. I do think that the registry idea is just one step in the identification of orphan works. And I also see that this is a great opportunity for grassroots outside the copyright arena office and for some enterprise to come up with other kinds of registries that will help. And so let it happen. Let the forces move. And I think that a lot of things are going to be solved without us solving them here. And I think it's going to be actually a good thing in the end. And the last thing that I would like to say, because I won't be in the afternoon panel, is that my greatest hope is to see balance, to see the balance between the rights of the owner and the rights of users. And I think that in the past we have forgotten that users have rights, and we have been concentrating entirely too much in the last years dealing with copyright to give much more power to the owner at the expense of what the user should be getting in the deal. It's a deal, and we're being shortchanging our users a lot.
Okay, Maureen?
I almost hate to comment. That's such a nice little thought to go to lunch with. But I do want to make sure, just a point of clarification, when the museum group talked about a voluntary notice or of use of orphan works, we did not intend, nor do we think it's a good idea to do it, an intent to use. It really would be concurrent or afterwards, but intent to use doesn't work for us.
Okay, let's. Thanks for a good start to this roundtable. Let's go to lunch. Then a couple of warnings. The warning is there is.
I'll have everyone just introduce themselves for the record.
Thanks for coming to participate.
Our second topic is. Consequences of an orphan works designation, and Oliver is going to tee that up for us and give us an intro to it. But before we do that, we have some new faces at the table, and I just want to make sure for the record we have identify everyone, even if you've told us who you are before. Let's go around and identify yourselves and your organization for this afternoon session of the roundtable.
Language Institute in Monterey, California.
I'm Christine Sundt, resurrected from the dead. I've been allowed to come back to the table. And I am with University of Oregon. I'm here representing College Art Association, Visual Resources Association, and independent artists. Oops.
All right, Alexander McGillivray of Google.
Ken Hammer from the J. Paul Getty Trust.
Carl Johnson, Brigham Young University.
Brewster Kahle, Internet Archive.
Joe LaSuzzo, Walmart, and also representing a seat from the Photo Marketing Association.
Jerry McBride, Music Library Association.
Dwayne Butler, University of Louisville University Libraries.
Charlie Pettit, Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America.
David Eber, Houghton Mifflin Company.
Bruce Funkhauser, Copyright Clearance Center.
Chris Sprigman, University of Virginia Law School, here on behalf of Creative Commons and Save the Music.
Gary Strong, University Librarian at UCLA.
I'm Kenny Cruz from Indiana University, where I direct the Copyright Management Center and serve on the faculty.
Maureen Whalen at the Getty Trust.
Stephen Gottlieb with the Recording Industry Association of America.
Mark Meyerson, representing the MPAA.
Brian Schottlander, University of California, San Diego.
And Gail Silva, president of Film Arts Foundation.
Okay, I'm going to turn it over to Oliver to describe the general topic of this section and to ask the first question.
Welcome, everyone, and welcome back. For those of you who are here this morning, this topic is number 2, the consequences of an orphan work designation. So for this discussion, we're going to assume that a work is an orphan work and has been properly designated, and we will not be discussing the criteria that we were discussing this morning. The written comments we received ran the gamut from saying that the consequence should be nothing, that the law should change to accommodate orphan works, to the opposite extreme, that the consequence should be that the work falls into the public domain. Many comments were in the middle of that spectrum and proposed some sort of limitations on remedies approach. In this discussion, we'll be discussing what the precise parameters of those limitations should be. The measure and the timing of any payments that might come under that kind of regime, and any additional conditions that the orphan work should meet under that regime, and also the issue of piggybacking, which we didn't really discuss this morning. Can one user rely on the search of a previous user? One of the issues that's come up, and I'd like to start the discussion with this, is a reasonable search has been done, whatever criteria for orphan works that is established has been met. At that point, the user can go forward and use it. But what happens if the user subsequently does come into knowledge of who the true owner of the work is? This could happen in a variety of different ways. It could just be accidental. It could be in searching for another work. But the question we're hoping to hear input on is, on day one, I've satisfied whatever criteria they are. Day two, I find out, oh, wow, now accidentally I did find out who owns this. Or maybe it's day 200. How does that affect the use that I've already started? Sure, go ahead.
Thank you. Again, I'm Kenny Cruz. In general, we have other examples like this problem in the existing law. For example, under Section 108, there are requirements or permissions for users to make certain uses of works, but subject to a search of the market, for example. And that means that a use may be allowed under Section 108 on day one, because a search of the market reveals that this work is not otherwise available. But the market may change, the work may become available, and once it becomes available, then on day two, when it's available, then Section 108 may not allow the particular use. So we do have examples like this in the law already. So what you're suggesting really is not something that we should treat as new or necessarily a problem. So to answer the question then more directly about it, my suggestion is that at least there are two broad types of uses. And for lack of a better label, and I certainly am looking for better labels, one label is a changeable use and the other label is an unchangeable use. And we've alluded to this already in the earlier discussion. A typical changeable use would be if I post something on my website, that if you were to surface and make whatever appropriate objection, I could remove that expeditiously, to borrow the language from the Act. And that would be, that is a typical kind of changeable use. And I think that should be treated in one manner, as opposed to what might be labeled an unchangeable use. If I, as we've already alluded to this morning, am using your work as a proper orphan work, using it in a proper manner, but I print it in a book. Now that book is going to stay on people's shelves in libraries, et cetera, indefinitely. That we might call an unchangeable use because I can't remove it once it's there and once it's out in circulation. And so I think that these two types of uses should be treated differently with different types of mechanisms for the allowance of use, different types of mechanisms for getting us to this stage, disallowing the use, and probably different penalties should the use continue. Okay.
Christine, Charles, David.
Nowadays we have the Internet Archive and we also have Google Cache. So, I mean, the fact that something is taken off the Internet doesn't mean that it's gone forever. So, again, I think we've got to get out of the mindset of thinking only in the way things happened in the text print world and move beyond that. I do think that Kenny's right that there's enough in the law that tells us how we should do this. We also have the possibility that if somebody doesn't agree to a negotiation, which is step number one, beyond the identification and the being told or telling you to stop using something, that there's recourse in the law. It's already written in there. And we can accept that.
One of the principal issues that frequently arises, even aside from the archiving issue, is the question of exactly what steps one has to take in order to withdraw that. I'm not sure that we could legislate, for example, where that boundary is as fast as technology changes. But there is also the question, and I think this is kind of intertwined, as to the nature of what the exact use was. I would imagine we would want to take a different step between a literal copy of an entire work versus something that had been a derivative, and I know that that may be jumping a bit far ahead looking at the other questions, but I think that that's equally relevant here, is trying to figure out not just whether it's a changeable use or a non-changeable use, but what kind of use was made that makes it changeable or non-changeable.
If I understand the question, it's assuming that the reasonable search had been made and it satisfied that standard, if then somebody comes forward. The position.
Well,
that,
let me just clarify. It's not precisely if someone comes forward
or
claims,
if there
but
is
if
knowledge.
You discover information, it if would be you,
right. Right.
It would be the question, and I think to clarify from Kenny's response, it would be. Let's say you have put it up on in a changeable use on a website, but you discover who the owner is before the owner ever says anything about it. Is there any obligation for you to change that use before someone ever shows up? That's sort of the trigger.
I mean the position that I take on just the broader issue of what kind of limitation of remedies, for example, there would be, which is the position that I believe in, is that one of the remedies you don't get if you have properly satisfied the reasonably diligent search element is that there can be no injunctions, because that's actually extremely serious and one of the most difficult things to imagine happening after you've put something in a publishing program, for example. If we were not protected, we would be facing a situation where we, depending on the nature of the injunction or whatever it was, we might have to either rip up existing materials or just not do another reprinting or something like that. If we're going to have a solution that says you have to remove it, even if it's easy to remove and technically because it's on a website, it still seems to me has vitiated the value of the orphan works provision getting rid of injunctions, because it affects the same thing, which is to say you have spent a lot of time assembling a publication, a work, all the pieces go together, and then all of a sudden you have to remove something. So I don't think whether it's the fact that someone affirmatively shows up and tells you or you just happen upon it later, it seems to me once you have satisfied that first prong where you get to make some sort of less risky use, that you shouldn't have to remove something. Now there's a further distinction, which I know a lot of the, which is a very very tough decision, which is, can you continue making your use if it's the same use forever for a certain amount of time? Can you create a derivative of your use? Those are very difficult issues. I have a position on them. Maybe we'll get to them, but at least I think that we don't want to have the effect of an injunction if the idea is that you eliminate the remedy of an injunction.
I guess to state the question and think a little bit differently is, at what point does the user get the benefit of that sort of no injunction status in a reasonable efforts search system? And stated differently, it's when does your obligation to stop, when can you stop searching? When can you, I mean, at what point, from that point forward, you don't have to be looking anymore, and if you come across information, then we're in the realm of assessing what the limited remedies might be available, what the limitations on remedies would be. Do we need to fix a point in time somehow at which your reasonable search has been concluded, and or do we not? Can we leave it as sort of a flexible approach that just you assess it looking backwards? That's part of the answer, David, and then Carl.
For sort of the reasons I said in response to what the other question, which I thought was a question, it seems to me it cannot be an ongoing, never-ending search, because then the value of having no injunctive, the potential of injunctive relief over your head is you're never going to be free of that. So, you know, if you can't get that, then you've lost a lot of the value. I mean, at some point, as I said earlier this morning, I view the reasonably diligent search to be more or less, I mean, it will change depending on people, but it's more or less supposed to replicate what, say, we or our authors do when we're searching somebody. The only difference is that at the end, if you have a dead end, you can use it as opposed to you can't use it. You do end those things. I mean, you move on, you do other things. So you do what you do. You create whatever record you want to create in case you're challenged later, and then you're done. But I don't see that you can kind of keep doing it forever.
Was your question suggesting that once an orphan, always an orphan? Was that part of your?
It's really a question of
exploring that at least.
I guess it's a question of when the once an orphan begins, in the reasonable search scenario. At what point should it be something where the user sort of self-certifies that they've done the search, and from that point forward they believe they're within the Orphan Works regime? Or is it a point at which they don't have to do that, and down the road, when an issue arises with an owner who surfaces, we just sort of sort that all out by looking back over the record that they've created and the record that existed at the time? Is it necessary for us to sort of make as part of the system, as soon as you've reached the dead end point that David was describing, do you have to put a stamp somewhere that says, I've searched? Or do you not have to do it? When does that once an orphan begin? I don't think I'm suggesting that it's always an orphan, but the once an orphan time begin.
Well, without recounting all the discussion of the morning, but to me, the answer to that specific question, in my opinion, goes to the definition of the orphan work itself. That discussion, and I offered a comment on not only unlocatable, unidentifiable, but unresponsive, and I still make that point. But whatever definition we settle on, I think inherent in the definition is a changing result based on new discovery. And so I don't think it, to answer my own question, I don't think it can be once an orphan, always an orphan. It shouldn't be. It can't be, and it shouldn't be.
Oliver has an example, I think.
So now to answer the question, what happens when there is more discovery? I think that's part of your question, or the underlying question. Original question was, what happens when there is discovery? And I think that to answer that, we should ask the question, who's in the best position to evaluate due diligence or a reasonable search, and do that on the least inexpensive transactional communication level? And that is, to me, is for a user to present the evidence to the copyright owner. And that discussion can be a discussion, it can be a disagreement, it can be a number of things. But if the copyright owner disagrees, then all of the options of adjudication are open to them. It's either an orphan work by settling it by person-to-person communication, or it's a disagreement, and it's the same way we would look at an infringement. I don't agree with your cursory search. You've infringed my work. I'll give you just notification and whatever. I'll start the process of notifying you about copyright infringement. Or we will continue to talk until we have an equitable settlement, a negotiated settlement about prospective uses, past uses perhaps, although I think as a policy we shouldn't put a undue burden on past uses.
It may help to clarify the question to give an example. If I have a book that has 20 photos in it and it comes time for me to clear the rights in them, and I put aside a reasonable amount of time to do that, and I say, okay, number one, and I do everything humanly possible to find the author of the photograph, and I'm unable to, and I am perfectly willing to swear under oath that I've done everything reasonable, and everyone would agree that I have done everything reasonable. I'm done with number one, and that was, you know, this morning's criteria. Done. I go on to number two, and I say, oh, this one's going to be a little easier because it's got a name on it. So I actually track that person down on a website and so on. Maybe they've got all their works listed there. And as I'm scrolling through, I say, oh, wow, there's photo number one. So yesterday I just determined that after weeks of work that it's not locatable. The next day I quickly find, by fortuitous accident, there's the photo. Now, I'm still a month away from publication. Do I get to publish number one under the Orphan Works regime?
Well, by definition, it changed from unidentifiable to identifiable.
Okay. Well, and Jules' point was, yesterday I had reached the point where all the criteria were satisfied. Does that ball of string get unwound?
Okay, let's start with Joe and then Dwayne. Let's go with Alex, then Charlie, and then Kenny.
I think at the point you find it, it's not that it's not copywritten anymore. I mean, it's still protected under copyright. It's not that you, I mean, you did what you had to do, but it wasn't marked clearly enough to find the owner. Now that you found the owner, I mean, think of it this way. If you found the owner in the first place, what were you going to do? Were you going to spend money and get that release? Well, I think that's, you got to do the right thing. You got to fess up and say, okay, I missed it, and now I got to pay him. And I mean, just from our side, again, very simplistic piece, we've done it several times where we've had folks bring pictures in, and we've copied them based on the criteria that they've gone and searched for the photographer, couldn't find them. Once they copied the picture, maybe weeks, even months, if not years later, we found a photographer come forward and say, you copied one of my pictures. Doing the right thing is paying the photographer what they would have gotten had they sold that picture to the customer. So I guess if you're asking what you should do, if it does happen, it should be based on reasonable amount of money paid to that person based on if you went to them in the first place and got the, whether it's a photograph or a music work or whatever. So, I mean, if you were going to sit down and negotiate and it cost you $5,000 to use it, well, then you should be paying them $5,000 if you discover it. I guess that's just my take on it based on what we would do, just do the right thing.
Dwayne was next.
Well, my question on that particular hypothetical is whether you could then still argue that that's reasonable if you have that subsequently acquired information, because it's kind of like the, even though they're separate entities, the use is still that one kind of activity. I'm going to publish it in that book. So the search is kind of multiple pieces, but it's the one use. So in that sense, one might not be finished until all 20 are finished. And that might go to the reasonableness of that kind of activity.
Wait, it was Alex was next, then Dwayne. Oh, wait, Alex, and then Charlie, and then Kenny, and then Christine.
Yeah, I would just go, I guess, one step further in terms of the benefit. One of the great benefits we see of this process is that it'll help people who want to get authorization for something actually find the person that they can get authorization for. So Google's preference would be in that case to actually go and talk to the person that did photograph one and photograph two, because you now know they're both out there. And I think in terms of Google's use, and this goes back to some of Brewster's comments in terms of our ability to stop using something, we'd be fine with something where you had to check some sort of location, like a voluntary registry or something, every once in a while. And if something then turned up in the voluntary registry, even though there was nothing you could have done foreseen that it would turn up, that would then stop your use, and you'd go and contract with the rights holder once you found them.
Charlie was next.
One of the comments that was made this morning and regarding the registry idea was whether registries should be whether idea intent to use or a prospective basis or an actual use. And I think that fits into this issue, too. Our position is actual use only, because until the book in the hypothetical has actually been published, all we've got is intent to use. In other words, until that book is out there, we're still in the clearance process. So even though I have marked on my checklist that I've completed the process for photo one, I haven't really done so because I'm still in the preparatory phase. This is a frequent problem with older works that originally appeared in periodicals, and that's why my organization is familiar with that. Frequently, older works appeared in periodicals. Short stories, serializations of novels appear 5 or 6 or 7 generations of name removed from the actual copyright holder, whether it's because of work for hire, whether it's because of the old indivisibility of copyright doctrine, whatever. The problem is, if I look in a magazine, or it'll say copyright 1942 Street and Smith Publications, when the actual holder might be Nightfall Incorporated, which is Isaac Asimov's holding company. I only need to spot one of those in the course of my 20 in order to get the knowledge for all of the rest. And that's where the intent versus actual use distinction becomes useful in this context, too.
Kenny was next, and then Christine and Brian and Marie.
Yeah, sticking with the familiar, if I can pick on Houghton Mifflin, for example, your mainstream book publishing industry you've so good at for 200 years, right? The if step one was this morning, the definition of what constitutes an orphan work, and I think to deal with the little piece of the struggle that we've had in this latest conversation about what if I finish what I think is finished, my search in July, but I really don't publish till December, but in October something comes to my attention. I think realistically, you weren't really done with your search in July. It's got to be determining the status of the orphan work, determining it is an orphan work, at a time approximately, reasonably close to the moment of actual use, when you put this book to press. So that was this morning's conversation. I think there's a timing element we just struggled with. But this afternoon's conversation is step two, defeating that orphan work status, and that would come after the use has been made, after the book has been published, after the website has been launched, whatever the resource may be. And this is where I think it has to be fairly explicit, that we're talking about defeating the orphan work status with information about the copyright owner that in fact comes to the attention of the user. In fact, not reasonably searchable, not could have been found if, but in fact comes to the attention of that user. And that may mean you stumbled across it, or it may mean that the copyright owner showed up on your doorstep. But either way, the information in fact came to your attention, verifiably that this is the status, and that may shift it out of that orphan works category. And this takes us right back to my opening point about what do we do then, your opening question, and my suggestion is I see two paths. Some of these uses are changeable, and I point to the Internet Archive. You're mimicking the 512 model. Send me a notice, and I'll take your stuff out of the archive. And I think that's pretty much where we are with changeable uses. Unchangeable uses, the book is printed, it's out on the shelves of 1,000 libraries around the country, and we hope 10,000 households in the country. And there's the book out there. We can't change it. But you can change future editions, and you probably have to. And then next step, step three, which we haven't gotten to in the conversation, I won't take you there, is what's the remedy for that past use? And I'll toss that one back.
Christine was next, and then Brian.
I think that we need to consider research and searching as the same thing. In other words, if somebody were to find facts that they had included in a whatever that were changed because of a recent discovery, those would be changed. And search is the same sort of thing, searching for rights clearance or searching for the image. If you stumbled on that image, even after you had the thing up in galleys, you'd still have an opportunity to change it. So I think that the notion of when it can when is the critical point is after it's in print or after it's up, but not at the point of doing the clearance.
Brian is next. Maureen was next. Maureen, you're next.
Oh, I'm sorry. I think all of us have received a call more than once, probably. That's all more than one. Who may not even be in the United States saying, I'm going to print this. Is there anything you want me to do differently? That last minute, this is it. Speak now or we're printing. And so somewhere between when the editors or the curators or the authors are first starting to put the plan together, have the first draft, the second draft, the third draft, this picture, that picture, some point from the start of that work in progress to the, we're here, we're printing, I hope it's okay. I think there is a proximate point in time when you know that it's fixed. It's not in the bookstores, it may not even be on the shores of the United States, but it's done. And I think that we have to allow people to use the material at that point so their investment is not lost. Now, how you like draw that line, I'm not sure. I also like the idea of actual knowledge. We've all had to deal with that concept as well, actual knowledge concept as well, actual there's known or should have known. And I think what we have to figure out is, does the second piece of that should have known apply if at the time, for whatever reason, you cross the bridge and you pass the test? So I think upon actual knowledge, before that point in time when your investment goes way up because of printing or fixation, and I would include digital in that point in time when your investment becomes big, because you know there's a lot of investment in putting stuff together for a web or a presentation or whatever. It's part of a whole thing that you're doing. So I think we have to look at proximate timing and actual knowledge and not continue this burden forever of constantly searching. That said, from the proposal that we submitted, we proposed a safe harbor time period, and that contemplated any reuse or new use that you would have to redo your search before you entered into your new period of your new safe harbor period. So I think when we were thinking about this, we felt that it was important that you saw this as a dynamic activity, but recognize that it can't be every single day.
Jerry and Charlie.
I'm wondering sometimes how changeable certain things are in looking at perhaps a website that you're designing. It may be technologically possible to change it quite easily. It's compared quite easily. It's comparing 500,000 copies of a book. But I'm thinking in terms of the things that we're thinking about doing as non-commercial libraries. If we have material that the copyright owners could not be found, and we go to a funding agency or so and apply for a grant, and we say to them, or they say to us, okay, have you cleared all the rights on this? And we go, well, here's X number of things that will be in this website for which we can find no owner. And it's still open-ended that somebody could come forth at any time. Would they be willing to provide that kind of investment that where the entire project could be pulled off, it could be pulled off entirely? So I'm not so certain that some things are quite so easy or quite so. I'm not so certain that some things are quite. Look, I think that's why the having some sort of clearly definable criteria for determining the orphan's work is really important.
One of the other issues that goes along with this is the shelf life of the use, for lack of a better term. Particularly at Houghton Mifflin, they don't ordinarily anticipate selling out an entire print run in 1 month, unlike with a magazine, typically, where for all practical purposes, the magazine is gone in a month. That leads to one possible problem that we would have with Mr. Ebers' suggestion that an injunction Ebers be available is whether that injunction might be available against I yet distributed. We would, from our perspective, we would not want something to be further distributed if it can be kept from leaving the warehouse at that stage. But that gets again into the question, not just within printed publication, but as things change and as media change and as the new media are developed, how are we going to define what our, quote, shelf life really is for this purpose? I don't think it's an easy question, but I think it's one we're going to have to face.
I'd like to go back to this notion of easily changeable publications. I wouldn't be so sanguine about the ease with which that is done. Put something in. Once you put something into, only one who's going to look at it and copy it potentially. That's if it's an object that nobody's interested in. In 2 months, maybe one person's copied it, and you can sort of repair that. If it's something that everybody's interested in, and so probably has high commercial value, it will be copied and fly around the network very quickly, as pulling all the library, all the books back out of the library and putting them in the warehouse. So I'm not sure that there's a real distinction there.
Brian, what's next?
So I'm glad Ken used the phrase that nobody had used yet. In Kenny's dichotomy, the dichotomy was dichotomy, that in Kenny's
Ken talked about easily changeable, and so much some of these easily changeable things really are to change. And I would say the reverse is equally true. I mean, we tend to act as though pulling thousands of books off of library shelves is like the end of the world, but the fact of the matter, it isn't really. It's all a matter of degree. So I think what does need to enter in, which I haven't heard anybody raise yet, I sort of thought Brewster might, is this notion of what it is you've done with the item. Consequences, let's say, in the digital realm in which Brewster may have archived, and it may be relatively easy to pull access copies, but Brewster may have philosophical reasons not to want us to pull something that he has actually preserved for a particular community. And I don't think it's as easy saying something is easy to change or not. You have to also take into consideration what specific use has the item been put to.
We're not considering also the possibility that the owner of the used work might be really happy to see it there and just say there and just really happy to see it there and just say happy to see it there and just we're looking at a lot of negatives right now, which is what our job is, but we have to think that there's probably going to be some benefit, ultimate benefit, by doing it and not be in the finite detail that may apply to 0.1% of situations.
Let me focus this discussion a little bit based on discussion. Maybe somewhere between what Kenny described as step one and step two, which is you've done the search, but before the owner, what other things should the user be obligated to do in that interim period, notifying their search in some way or taking some step to say that they've done their search, but organization term of your use on the doc on work that or their use if it's a derivative work that they're making. Christine mentioned attribution. Should there be an obligation to try to attribute to the best extent you could of a work. Term of your use. Maureen mentioned her organization also suggested that it only lasts for 5 years or 7 years or some period of time. I view this sort of as, you know, the terms and conditions of your orphan work use. Beyond payment or incurring a payment obligation or making payments, the other thing you might see in a licensing agreement as to what your work. So thoughts on things like that, whether it be notice on the use that you're making or in conjunction with the use that you're making, attribution, if you can make any, a limited term of your use that you might, you'd only enjoy it for a certain period of time, other types of obligations that you have to incur to avail yourself of this system and exist before the owner comes back and tries to reclaim. So let's have some thoughts on that.
First, the continuing search obligation. Really problematic. All right, if we're going to have some kind of reasonable search standard, and again, I mean, what constitutes a reasonable search? You could think of it in a lot of different ways, and we explored that. But if we're going to have some kind of reasonable search standard, I think at some point, the point is when some kind of significant reliance is undertaken, that obligation has to terminate. Okay. I think Kenneth made a very good point that, you know, what we're talking about here, I think, is a rare case where you actually find out something. You get some real information that you didn't have a day before. Okay, and again, I think the reliance barrier should apply. Once you've spent significant money to get, and if there's the possibility of that money having been wasted, money having an obligation under the standard that continues past your reliance, the extra uncertainty that creates is going to make it. What happens afterward? Now we're moving into this. So we've relied, and some work is now out in the marketplace that you've created based on the use of this orphan work. What happens if someone comes forward? Now, what Christine suggested about attribution, I think, is very intriguing, in the sense that it is a norm that is under-respected in the copyright law. And under-respected in our culture generally. And the reason I say this is because Creative Commons provides an opportunity for people to say, for creators to say, you can use my work, but give me attribution. And of the creators who choose to use the attribution. So that norm, if the Creative Commons population is very strong, creators as a whole, that norm of be, I think, if we define orphan works correctly, a comparative rarity that someone comes forward as, I want money. Even more of a rarity, but I think it'll be even more respect that they want. And if we build in some kind of mechanism for attribution into the law, I think, again, we work system usable, and we make it more respectful. And that's both good things.
Mark.
To take exception that people won't want money, based on the nature of the industry that I work in, If they smell a buck to be made from Titanic, you can better come after us.
It's an interesting discussion. I'm concerned about having where value can whatever the market bears. Obviously, from the filmmaker's view, they want of spending a lot of time and work before the production is actually even done. Trying to figure out how much everything, including rights, they have to everything, including. They can't always find everything on that first round. They also find a lot of material, and it gets into that whole area of intend to use. They may do the research of, by the time the film is actually completed and done, by the time the film is actually on it, by the time the show or whatever made distinct, it could be artistic, historical presentation of a certain idea or policy, time in history. I actually like the assumption about attribution a lot. There has to be an assumption that if people go to the trouble of researching for copyright, the source of a particular thing, and they can't find it, from their research, then it's in the orphan works category. So they use it. You can't put in use it. You they use it. And something comes up months later, and somebody says, well, I think that. You can't be in this position, I think, where people are limited from completing a work or distributing a work because of litigation or, the market will bear. I'm just happy using my name. Somebody else can say, well, that's going to cost you $1 million. There has to be some good faith effort. The figures down here on common use. I just think that everything's done in good faith. All the search is done. Perhaps there could be some sort of a set, if the owner popped up or the filmmaker in this case found out about it much later, that there wasn't the ability of stopping something from being shown. I understand the industry ability of stopping something from being perspective. On the other hand, I do think that it limits what the American public could see.
And we'll talk about payments or escrows or some sort of set aside in a moment. Some sort of set aside mechanism be used to do this. I mean, it seems like on the one hand, if you make it a requirement. There is always the question of, did you get it right? There is always the trip a lot of users up if they do it incorrectly. But otherwise, sort of a requirement that you try to attribute to the best you can. Is there a mechanism that you could do that could build in?
Now, my suggestion would be relatively limited in that if someone comes forward